I'll order the regular meeting of the Transportation Sustainability Committee for the City of Emeryville for July 8th, 2025. Your role.
Mayor Moore?
Here.
Chair Solomon?
Here.
Now I'll open for public comments. Do we have any written comment cards for people in the room?
Let me see.
All right, closing public comment. Move to approve, next item, approval of the June 10th, 2025 Transportation Sustainability Committee regular meeting action minutes.
I move approval.
A second.
Cool. Mayor Moore?
Aye.
Chair Solomon?
Aye.
Next item 5.1, citywide AB 413 daylighting.
It was much faster than we.
Chair Solomon, Philip Huff, Associate Civil Engineer with the Public Works Department, and presentation of the daylighting. First, a brief overview of what daylighting is. Daylighting is a safety improvement that restricts parking next to crosswalks that improves both the visual field for both pedestrians and drivers. AB 413 specifically restricts parking by vehicles within 20 feet of marked or unmarked crosswalks, or 15 feet within a crosswalk with a curb extension anywhere in California. The law went into effect January 1st of this. Here, this diagram shows this site triangle from the vehicle. You can kind of see where, if a vehicle was parked where the red curb is, how that would potentially obstruct the view of that driver, the view the driver would have of those pedestrians at the curb. This illustration shows how the daylighting would work at marked or unmarked crosswalks. At the marked crosswalks, the 20-foot dimension would be from where the paint is. At the unmarked crosswalks, we would take it on a case-by-case basis. So the 20-foot dimension would be either from the end of the curb return, be from the edge of the curb ramp, or if there's a stop bar, it'd be from that. So the 20 feet would start there. We would use our engineering judgment to kind of figure out how to position these daylighting locations in order to ensure the safety of pedestrians, bicyclists, and motorists. We have a few examples, the real-world Emeryville examples of daylighting locations. This particular location at 67th and Hollis is where one parking space will be removed for daylighting. And this is an interesting case because it's a paid parking, you can see by the parking meter there. So it will require additional step of coordination with the city's parking coordinator. So for the removal of that parking meter, removal or salvage or relocation of that parking meter. This is an example at a curb extension. This happens to be the 65th at the Greenway. You can see where there isn't any red curb there. So in general, at a curb extension, the 15 feet would extend from the crosswalk and go along the approach, the vehicle approach direction, 15 feet. In the last example, this is at 48th and Salem. We have an unmarked crosswalk, but there is a stop bar. So in this case, we would likely start the 20-foot daylight from the stop bar and paint the curb red 20 feet in the direction of that power pole there. Now, citywide implementation. Before they go out, our maintenance crews go out to perform these red curb paint, we will post signage at least 72 hours before, as is required, with these A-frames as kind of shown there. This particular example on the left is from the city of Brisbane, and they created their own no parking signage. It's kind of hard to read, but they had specific language mentioning AB 413 and daylighting. So we want to kind of emulate that and create our own reusable no parking signage that we can also use for notifying the public that there's a daylighting red curb coming. And on the other side of the A-frame, we would like to have, we want the opportunity to provide some education for the public. So this is kind of a draft of a flyer that we would have on the other side of the A-frame to kind of show the public why daylighting, what it means for them. And with links to Public Works General email, plus a link to a website that we are currently working on. So these are still work in progress. It's not the final flyer. And the website is under development as well. So we're working on that.
As a side note, the slogan actually came from our maintenance group. So
that's. Implementation timelines to kind of mitigate the big job and to make it more manageable and little batches of work. We're splitting the city into kind of quadrants with the intersection of Hollis and Powell. That's kind of our 0-0 coordinate. So the quadrants kind of branch off from there. Each quadrant should take about 2 months to complete by our own maintenance crews. And we anticipate completion by early of next year. So that brings us to our staff recommendation. And the recommendation is that the committee make a motion to approve the red curve at all locations of daylighting zones in the city of Emeryville in order to implement AB 413 guidelines of at a minimum 20 feet of the vehicle approach side of any unmarked or marked crosswalk or 15 feet of any crosswalk with a curb extension. We're happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
I just have one question. I'm not too familiar with unmarked crosswalks. Could you explain a bit more about, like, I think the one near Salem that you showed just looks like no crosswalk, but what would make that a unmarked crosswalk?
So the unmarked crosswalk is the language that AB 413 uses, but it refers to this type of this condition. So it is a little bit confusing, but I like to think of it as unmarked crossing is probably a better way of thinking about it. I think they were just maybe trying to make economy of words.
It's actually based off of the CBC.
Oh, okay.
So the vehicle code describes this scenario as an unmarked crosswalk. Legally, that is a crosswalk, even though it doesn't have paint to demarcate as such. In public common understanding, they only consider a crosswalk to be painted. But in a legal definition, there is a distinction.
That's because it has a stop sign and
it's not essentially jaywalking to cross.
Gotcha.
It's a legal crosswalk.
Got it. Okay. And it's a city could choose or not to choose to paint that, but either way, somebody could feel safe and not that they're not jaywalking by crossing there.
Legally they would not be.
Got it. Okay. No, that's new to me, so thank you.
I've got a couple of small questions, and feel free to, we can take some of them offline if
they're
helpful. So I know we approved a few months ago for the sustainable streetscapes work that was being done. We approved a few targeted daylighting measures. Is the idea with this motion that this would cover everything else, and would any of these come back to us again, or is this enough for you to go and do the work?
That's essentially the motion. It's a batch approval.
Okay, that's good. Do we have any sense of how many crosswalks we're talking about?
So I've started the analysis on the different intersections. I haven't completed it, but just kind of eyeballing it, it looks like to be somewhere between 100 and 150 locations.
Okay. Not all, some of which will already have complied. Just
right. So that's 100 to 150 that will need to be painted.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. And then the exact sort of, if you need 22 feet, you have leniency to make those decisions based on the specifics of the realities of the ground.
Hence the word minimum.
Gotcha. Okay, and those are all my questions. You're open for a comment. We received any comment cards? Then I'll close public comment and discussion.
I'll move approval for the staff recommendation to implement the daylighting.
I'll second that. Thank you in advance to all the teams for.
Mayor Martin?
Aye.
Chair Solomon?
Aye. Okay. Moving along. Item 6.1, the Greenway Safety Updates for Clay Terrace.
Thank you for the opportunity to present today. During one of the previous transportation commissions, we had a request to evaluate feasibility of stop control at the 65th, 66th, and 67th Greenway Trail crossings. So what the study does is, the study will essentially evaluate stop controls on the three streets, and also identify opportunities for any additional safety improvements based on our field observations. Next slide. So we want to start first by talking about the pros and cons of both an RRFP and a stop sign. With an RRFP, you can have a driver yielding compliance rate of about 98% by FHWA. You have a crash reduction of about 47%, but with stop control, there's a clear legal requirement for vehicles to stop if they choose to do so, if they feel it's necessary. But then the crash reduction is much lower, which is at about 25%. You typically see RRFPs, similar to trail crossings on streets at mid-block crossings with speeds less than 40 miles per hour. And stop controls are generally at multi-way intersections and where there is a higher driver expectancy. In terms of user experience, having an RRFP allows for continuous trail flow of pedestrian bicyclists, especially with passive ped detection, since it will always be activated when it detects a pedestrian or a bicyclist. Whereas there is limited safety with the stop sign, especially if drivers choose to ignore it or, do like one of the rolling stops. There are limitations to both. With an RRFP, if it is continuously active, it could desensitize drivers. Whereas with a stop control, its compliance varies. So there are pros and cons to both. Under existing conditions, and this applies to all three crossings, we have RRFPs, we have passive ped detection at all locations, so they are activated automatically as soon as they detect a pedestrian or bicyclist. There is pedestrian safety signage, cross traffic ahead signage on the trail crossings, race crosswalks, and speed cushions at 65th Street. We did a field review at the three trail crossings, walking back and forth, trying to understand what your average pedestrians, and you would know best, experience here. And some of our general observations were the trees that are close to the trail crossings, they block the view of the RRFP. So if you are driving from further away on any of these streets, it is the view of the RRFP sign is partially blocked. Another thing we observed that while we are at the curb ramp, at the trail crossings, at all three approaches, and you are able to see in both directions as a pedestrian or a driver. However, if you're further behind in the trail, when the parked cars on both approaches, especially at 65th and 66th, and at the westbound approach when you're coming southbound at 67, your view is partially blocked if there is a car present. These were some of our key takeaways from our fields review. Next thing. Once we conducted the field review, we conducted the stop warrant analysis with following MUTCD's guidelines. There are three specific guidelines provided for two-way stop controls at collecting 24-hour ADT counts, pedestrian and bicycle counts, and collision data. For the stop warrant analysis, they require collision data of 2 years, with 5 collisions having occurred at the location in 2 years. We evaluated a total of 6 years worth of data to identify any potential crashes that may have happened at any of the trail crossings. Now, for the purpose of the analysis, we chose the 65th Street and Greenville Crossing. We specifically chose this location because 65th Street historically has more traffic volume than the remaining two streets. And so this will be an always stop warrant meeting here could be applied to any of, or not meeting here could be applied to any of the remaining crossings. We also took the data from the eco counter at 66th Street and Greenway to get the pedestrian and bicycle counts. And then collision data we obtained from Switters. Now, based on the analysis that we did, the threshold for the traffic volume criteria is that the street should have a 6,000 vehicles per day threshold, and 65th Street had about 2750. So this criteria was not met. Sight distance, as I mentioned before, at the curb ramps, you do not have a visibility issue, and further behind the people when drivers are driving towards this trail crossing, there is no visibility issue. However, there may be visibility issue if you're further back on the trail. So in that sense, the criteria was not met. And in terms of crash history, there were no reported crashes in the past 6 years. Given these three criteria, the stop warrants at the locations were not met. We also chose to look at other sources for alternative safety treatments. One of them is the NCHRP report 6562, which is often used to evaluate pedestrian crossing safety treatments. What this evaluation does is the methodology for this evaluation is similar to the stop warrant analysis. You collect data. Primarily, you will collect traffic volumes, pedestrian volumes, and you would out in field. You would look at driver compliance to pedestrians. Once you get all this data, you calculate pedestrian delay, and based on the delay that you get, then you come up with your treatment selection. We did this for similar to the stop warrant. We did this for the 65th Street crossing. And as you can see from the graph on the right, about the pedestrian volumes, like there were about 300 vehicles during the peak PM hour, which is about 5 to 6. And there were about 300 vehicles, but the pedestrian volumes were also around 243. And based on the pedestrian delay, which was about 0.7 hours, it was a range that puts the crossing at a standard crosswalk with standard crossing treatments. So essentially, having an RLP is an enhanced crossing. So with the safety treatments, alternative safety treatments evaluation, no further safety treatments were recommended at the C crossings. Next slide. However, as I mentioned before, we did field review and identified that there were a few visibility issues that could be rectified. Some of them include tree trimming at all three crossings, so that the RFV sign is more visible to drivers on the road. Additionally, we recommend removing one parking space on each of the approaches on 66th Street, and then one parking space on the westbound approach at 67th Street, and also daylighting along with the parking adjustment. And this would improve the visibility for both for the trail users on the trail further behind from the crosswalks, and improve visibility of the RFD sign for the oncoming vehicles. Next slide, please. Another step of the study, and this is more of an amendment to the study, is a review of policies and practices that are conducted by, that are being used by other agencies for establishing speed limits for bicycles. We looked at CMUTCD, NACTO, and guidelines from other agencies. And essentially what CMUTCD says is that a regulatory speed limit is allowed. It does not have a preference of what that is, if the city feels the need to apply it. NACTO recommends about 10 to 15 miles per hour on shared use paths. There was a comprehensive study done by Marin County in 2014 that looked at several locations in California and as well as in other states. And through their review, they identified that general practice was to use 8 miles to 15 miles per hour limits, with about 10 miles proposed at locations with high pedestrian volumes. We did a quick analysis of review of what the pedestrian volumes look like on a daily basis. And in 2025, we have about a daily average of 1,350 pedestrians using the trail crossing, and about 716 bicycles using the trail crossing. So that it is being used heavily by pedestrians. Oakland, a few examples are the San Francisco Bay Trail. It uses about 15 miles per hour, but Oakland, it uses also 15 miles per hour, but it is reduced to 5 miles near pedestrians. So the purpose of this review, and it is still in progress, is to come up with an appropriate speed limit for the MVU, for the Greenway, for bicyclists on the trail. And this will improve both safety for pedestrians and bicyclists, and also improve like the trail traffic flow. With that, I will pass it on to Phil for next steps.
I think what we'd like to get from the committee is some feedback on what was just presented. And I'd also like to point out that with the Sustainable Streets project, there will be some speed humps added at the crossings leading up to the raised crosswalks. So that's an additional safety measure that hasn't been installed yet. So it's not part of the memo that was written, but it's upcoming as part of the paving portion of the Sustainable Streets.
Which streets were those? Sorry.
It's the three streets that were mentioned in the middle, 65th, 66th, and 67th. So at the Greenway crossings.
So 65th has the speed hump already.
It has the speed cushion. So we're going to do asphalt.
Speed humps. Okay.
Which we tend to, our take on it, I mean, a lot of these features are about psychological impact to the driver. Do they respect the what is there in front of them, or do they not do so? Almost like the difference between the thicker plastic versus the thin plastic vertical nanometers. The physical reality for their car doesn't really make that much of a difference, but they treat them differently. So that's kind of our thinking with going to asphalt.
Hmm. When are those due to be repaved? Can you remind me? Is that? Yeah.
Yeah. So later this summer.
Okay, so that's part of the
Hollis work.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Once they start paving on the Hollis, then once they get their paving scheduled for Hollis, then they're able to fit in these little speed humps and things, because it's not just at the Greenway. There's other speed humps around town that we.
Okay. So it's not all of 65th, 66th, 67th are being repaved.
We use the same contract because it's the same material.
So while they're mobilized for paving for Hollis, they can do paving.
And also, Shruti, one of the things in your analysis, if you could clarify, combining both RFP and a stop sign at the same crossing. Can you clarify the legal position on that?
So when you one of the downsides of the RFP, and if you want to go back to the old site, is that when you have an RFP, you cannot have a stop sign at the same time because they're conflicting traffic controls.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to implement a stop sign, you would essentially remove the RFP and with that, the passive threat detection that comes with how the RFP is activated. That is one unfortunate thing about having to do the switch is now you would leave, which is now, if the location is currently, it has the passive threat detection where your pedestrians do not press anything, they don't have to stop, they just keep going and the drivers are aware. When you switch to stop control, that will change.
But it's not, we're essentially not recommending stop control since it doesn't meet the warrants and RFBs are more effective at crash reductions.
But you legally can't have both.
We have to choose.
And then just to kind of give a little bit of insight to the legal logic for it, there's a physical reality. One is that you're conditioning the driver psychologically that when the light is flashing, there is a person, therefore definitely react, versus this is a regulatory tool. You need to stop at this location no matter what, whether you see somebody or you don't see somebody. And that's kind of what it's a different instruction and message to the driver.
So it seems, so just to summarize again, RFBs are both more effective and stop signs are less effective and also not warranted given the volumes. So status quo is the most effective for.
Yeah.
And also what is recommended based on.
Yes, with the additional changes for improving.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Any other moving questions?
On the topic of improving the visibility, I think it makes a lot of sense where as drivers are approaching, they can see something that line matches what they're seeing with the beacons, the flashing, right? I go on this like 5 or 6 times a day. So your observations really resonate. So thanks for being down on the ground and actually living that experience. So I can really see how the red curb helps there, and the tree trimmings. I've noticed, especially the trees are right now very just kind of overgrown. It's aesthetically nice, but for visibility, it causes problems. So my question, it comes down to the tree trimming. Is this something, how does this get routinely done? Because this is not like tree trimming on the greenway where like maybe in a windstorm, a branch might fall down. This is more like a constant state of safety, awareness, visibility. So what's the mechanism within the city that we can, is there a mechanism that can kind of help us stay on top of that as opposed to this being like a one-time thing and then it gets overgrown again and then somebody maybe, I don't know, comes back to transportation committee and we get them trimmed again?
Yeah, that's a good point. The immediate mechanism is our tree services contract. And we have a sort of citywide plan. They go through the various corridors in the city, assess them and trim them. I think we held off on addressing this immediately because we felt it was needed. We needed to have the study and the discussion. And once this discussion is completed, our intention is to go out there. We already have the authorization for daylighting, so we're able to paint the red curb under that authorization and proceed with routine trimming.
Are there any red curbs here that are being recommended that are not covered by the daylighting authorization? That is, do we need a separate action item in the future to enable the additional red curb visibility recommendations?
Well, I mean, because it said 20-foot minimum, right? And it gives us essentially some leeway with 15. we would use our discretion, and we would consider that discretion underneath the authorization you all gave us to make it work if we see any site-specific needs to add a few feet or reduce a few feet as appropriate.
And I just had one more question. The curb discussion is interesting because on 65th Street, where there's that speed hump, it's making the drivers slow down, and they are then also able to take in more of the incoming traffic. So I think that helps things a lot. So I'm glad that we're considering speed humps on 67th and 66th. My question, though, is when you move to asphalt, so right now the cushion that's there, it's like a predetermined, you know, angle, width, like it is actually somewhat unpleasant for cars to go over that at speed. So I consider that one particularly well designed. I've driven over a lot of asphalt speed humps, some of which are very unpleasant because of how sharp they are, and I guess they do their job sometimes too much. And other ones which are just these wide, almost, I mean, some cars even enjoy driving over them because they're just kind of a fun experience. So my question is, in terms of the asphalt speed hump, or why wouldn't we consider just the same speed cushions, just bolt them on? Are those like more difficult to maintain? And then if we are really going with the asphalt, a speed hump design, do we have something in mind that we know will be effective, like the speed cushion that we have on 65th?
We've done a little bit of iteration on the asphalt design. We think we're at the right place right now. It is larger than the plastic ones, and it's our expectation that it's going to be more effective.
Okay, that's great.
Two small questions. Has this gone to BPAC, or is it expected to go to BPAC?
We're happy to take it to BPAC based on your comments. I mean, we weren't intending to. I think this was an item raised here as a future agenda item. That's why we brought it back here. We're open to it.
Okay. That's good. And then I think the answer to this is no, because it's outside of our jurisdiction. Obviously, the Greenway goes up to Berkeley, and it's not 68, but whatever the street is beyond 67 is notably, you know, the button you have to press, it doesn't feel as safe. I don't know, have we had any discussion with the good people of Berkeley of whether or not they want some kind of continuity?
The speed hump, perhaps.
Yeah, speed hump. Obviously, an RFP would be nice, but like, yeah, just having some consistency for cyclists, pedestrians going up the Greenway that they can expect something similar.
That is a comment we have received in our transportation committee, and we will be happy to pass that on to them.
All right, sounds good. Thanks. Yeah, I will.
Maybe ask them if anyone's ever pushed the button.
Perhaps we can reach out to our compatriots.
Either city manager.
Oh, yes, yeah, so okay, sounds good. Let me open this for public comment and then have a short comment, short discussion. Did we receive any comment cards?
No.
Any comments in the room? All right, close public comment. Maybe I'll just say I think it would, recognizing take staff time, I think it would be helpful if that was to go to BPAC just as an informational. The reason I say that is I think it came up in discussion there. I don't know if it was ever a future agenda item, but I feel more confident now the current approach is what would be best if we were designing it again. And so I think that, assuming that they come away with the same conclusion, I think that might be helpful.
So I want to concur. I think it's a great presentation. It's very logical. It walks people through the thought process through the city's perspective, helps people understand why there aren't stop signs. Now I get that, and I can see that this is the correct approach. And it also shows why people are going to see a flurry of changes now with red curbs and tree trimmings, and now they'll understand the why behind that. So I think we should be proud of this work, and I think letting BPAC see the thought that went into it, I think is a just as an information item, it's probably worth the extra time.
Good.
But thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Wonderful. With that, I'll close item 6.1. Is just information. You don't need to.
Can I just add one more thing? If you do find that you need to come back for any of these, you're measuring the 20 feet and you do need some extra red curb, please do add it back to a future agenda.
That's what we'll do.
Anything else?
That's it.
All right. So we don't need any motion or anything.
Yeah.
All right. Closing item 6.1, move on to 6.2, which is sea level rise and groundwater emergence.
I think Matt's going to do a little more.
It's going to be a tag team today. So, hello everyone. Matt Anderson, Environmental Services Supervisor. I'm joined today by Amber Evans, Violet Rice, and guest appearance by Mira Desat from Planning. I'm here to do a quick update on new science relating to sea level rise, groundwater emergence, and potential impacts to the city of Emeryville. Quick background why we're here. A good portion of the city of Emeryville is only 15 to 20 feet above mean sea level, which means that potential sea level rise is a big issue to the city. And it's been addressed in planning documents and actions by the city for some time, including our general plan, climate action plan, local mitigation plan, and many others. But recently, several new data sets and studies have come out of particular interest. In 2024, the state released guidance for jurisdictions on how to plan for sea level rise. And in 2022, a study was completed on mapping shallow groundwater in the Bay Area. That was fairly comprehensive, and previous environmental program supervisor Nancy Humphrey actually participated in that study as well. So in response to some of this new data and information coming out, the city formed an internal task force, representatives of everyone you see here, public works, environmental programs, community development, and planning. We've been meeting regularly to talk about some of this information, holding discussions internally with staff for education, and how some of these items may be brought to the public, brought to you all, and addressed. So I'm going to pass it over to my colleague, Amber Evans, who can provide a little more background and pass on our efforts.
So strange, because the presentation's over there and the audience that are there, so I'm not sure the TV should stay that. But I'll just look at my screen. Given part of the reason that staff started being convened at Boston's departments is that we became aware almost 2 years ago, I had applied on behalf of the city for SB1 funding. That was not successful. It was solely focused on the Emeryville Crescent. It was solely the city trying to muster an effort in a large regional complex environment. And since then, it was kind of a stone soup situation. We put that pebble out there. And regional organizations and our neighbors to the north started talking with us about what collaborations might look like. So I'm happy to announce that we've just submitted a new SB1 application, but it was actually San Francisco Estuary Partnership that did that on behalf of ourselves, working with Oakland, but Oakland has a separate application, but in partnership with Albany and Berkeley. So that we might all get to our regional shoreline adaptation plan in collaboration with each other. We'll get you a lot more detail about that, but that's the context of why are we here and the background, and that one grant led to the next. At that same time, legal obligations have come into play. The regional shoreline adaptation requirements from BCDC in compliance with state law have given us guidance about what we will have to do in our plan. I think part of what Matt's introduction was to say that you might have expected him to bring this item to you, the sustainability. So why is a planner? I needed somebody who maybe isn't sitting in the planning department, but I do have a planning degree, bringing this to you. And it comes maybe from the source of I was doing grant writing at the time, building on some collaborations that were already happening, and now we're here. Those regional partnerships make a huge difference, given that we have Caltrans and the port sitting right at our front door, And with SFEP, they're able to bring them and the Army Corps and everyone else that needs to bring to bear in this. See, as I go through this presentation, we don't even own one land that's in the Crescent at our front door. So we need to have these kind of partnerships to move forward. But as we do that, we will be bringing it back and doing preparatory work for our general plan and the update in 5 years of the long-range hazard mitigation plan that we just submitted. So in some ways, there's kind of a question of, do you want your general plan before your regional shoreline? But as I talk about that, a lot of the planning that we'll have to do for the regional shoreline will fit very well into a new general plan that is considering. Next slide, please. Thank you. So we're just going to go through the why, some of which I've given you in the background. The predicted impacts on Emeryville assets, and Violet will do her excellent job on that portion of our presentation. And then I'll walk through the regional shoreline adaptation plan requirements. And then we'll talk to you about some outreach that is both happening because other projects are moving forward and our own collaborations. Next slide, please. I was referring to the legal obligation, that's SB 272, that requires the regional shoreline adaptation plans. That guidance came from DCDC last fall. We don't need to comply until January of 2034. However, there's some real reasons to take action now. One is cost savings, $1 now versus $6 later, but also that partnership that I started to allude to. We just submitted an application for $2.5 million that brings $300,000, if awarded, to supporting staff time in Emeryville life in that regional effort. Next slide. The consideration of sea level rise is actually of multiple impacts. We're not only worried about tidal inundation, which we might think of as sea level rise, but also storm events that might bring events that we expected later, earlier on certain days. Also, because we have a very shallow, and Violet will see the particulars of this, groundwater, we may see the emergent groundwater or the permanent arising of groundwater present on our streets and properties. And that is a factor of our shallow groundwater. So we'll be looking at that. Next slide, please. And so building off that last slide, we're really seeing the cumulative effect of all of those factors. Not every day, but on the worst day, and we'll start to talk about good days and the worst day, but we'll have runoff, precipitation, sea level rise, 100-year storms, high tide, a king tide, all of it could be the compounding that we need to think about in terms of threats. Slide, please. But on the other hand, what it means is that we can do our planning now where we're seeing some of those worst impacts, where we're starting to see storm surges that are creating problems that give us an ability to incrementally work to when we have a storm and that first increment of sea level rise so that we're prepared for when we have a larger sea level rise, and then maybe it will be on storm days that we need to be responsive. Next slide, please. An awkward transition here, but in addition to the sea level rise, as Matt alluded to, we're also looking at what is happening with in response to rising sea levels, our groundwater rising, and the potential impact for that on our infrastructure. Seawater being at our pipes and all the infrastructure we have under groundwater. And so we're thinking about shallow groundwater and emergent groundwater, as I already said. And we got that new data from 2022.
Yeah, and so if we take a look at our sea level rise predictions and different sea level rise scenarios, as Matt mentioned, all of these do come from California's 2024 sea level rise guidance update. We have three different years and three different scenarios up here, but today in this presentation, we are specifically going to focus on the year 2060 and the intermediate high and high scenarios. And we chose specifically to focus on the intermediate high scenario because of current federal attitudes, I guess you could say, about climate change, the intermediate high scenario might be more likely to play out than initially thought. The high scenario is still unlikely to occur in real life, but it provides a good contrast and a look into a really bad day or the worst case. And we are focusing on 2060 just simply because when modeled, 2040 sea level rise predictions don't actually look like much on the upper shoreline. It's very difficult to tell what's going on, whereas 2060 predictions provide the picture of potential future impacts. However, we do have 2040 and 2100 predictions up here just to demonstrate how quickly sea levels are predicted to rise. And so if we look at our first map, again, we are looking at the year 2060 and we are looking at that intermediate high scenario. So what we see here is 1.5 feet of sea level rise inundation, as well as 1 foot of flooding due to king tide. And king tide flooding is, of course, temporary flooding, but king tides do happen about 4 times every year here in the Bay Area. So we do have to consider them and we do have to be prepared for them. And this scenario is nicknamed the good day because this is probably one of the best case scenarios we might experience. And there really isn't too much going on this map. There is some swelling of Temescal Creek. It's very hard to see. There's a little tiny bit of flooding by the Marina Park bathroom, but it doesn't look very concerning, which is definitely in contrast to this map. We are still in 2060, but we are now looking at the high sea level rise scenario. So this is 2 feet of inundation. Again, that 1 foot of temporary king tide flooding, but we've now added 3 feet of flooding due to a storm surge, which is also temporary flooding. So were a king tide and a storm surge to occur simultaneously and this high scenario to play out in real life, Emeryville might potentially experience some pretty significant inland flooding. And it is worth noting that that inland flooding is not predicted to be very deep, but it is still not welcome, especially all of that flooding at Point Emery and across Powell. And then a hard turn to groundwater. We are looking at the current groundwater levels throughout the city. Again, as Matt mentioned, this comes from SFEI's shallow groundwater response to sea level rise study, which came out in 2022. And those orange splotches, or I should say those darker orange splotches, note groundwater that the study measured to be within 3 feet of the ground surface, which is extremely shallow. That yellow is groundwater 3 to 6 feet from the surface. And those blue triangles note EPA Superfund sites. Emeryville does have 11. None of them made it on the national priority list, but they are up there just as a reminder of how contaminated our groundwater is here. And if we just focus on Doyle Hollis Park, where it is dark orange here, is likely to emerge first. So where we saw orange, we are now starting to see purple. So if we look at the year 2060, we are looking at the intermediate high sea level rise scenario with 1.5 feet of sea level rise. It is predicted that we might see some permanent groundwater emergence in very small parts of the city, but namely around Doyle Hollis Park. And something else important about this groundwater model is that it factors in sea level rise and sea level rise only. So king tides and storm surges do have some temporary impact on the water table and they can cause some temporary groundwater emergence, but we are not looking at that on these maps. We are looking at the impact of sea level rise and sea level rise only. And if we wanted to see how this might escalate, and we stay in the year 2060, but we jump to our high scenario with just another 0.5 foot of sea level rise, permanent groundwater, or groundwater might potentially emerge permanently around Doyle Hollis Park, but also in a few other areas like by ECCL, Public Market, down there by Hoochin Park, or sort of the top of the Emeryville Crescent.
As we were seeing both the combination of groundwater and sea level rise through the slides that I presented, the Relay Regional Shoreline Adaptation Plan is asking us to look at both factors and looking at the multi-threat that we analyzed before. But it's given pretty specific guidance to all local jurisdictions on sea level rise adaptation planning. So we are required by DCDC to provide a plan that not only has a pretty prescribed process, but needs to look at our existing conditions, do a complete vulnerability assessment, look at adaptation strategies, review our land use and policy for how we might incorporate adaptation plans into our planning process and look at project funding plans. So looking at by the end of this funding, which is considered a 2-year process, we would be looking at projects with cost estimates associated with that to be responsible for adaptation and models as you saw here, resulting in project lists. Next slide, please. We imagine and have indicated that we would work with all the departments. One of the key things about my situation in the city is that I tend to be the interdisciplinary planner, the one that works in all the different departments and brings them together. So with that, we anticipate that the planning process is going to involve anybody that's touching the infrastructure or buildings. We have built structures on the marina and also, as we saw, park spaces and city schools. But that we would also be coming back to you, the city council and city manager, with when we had key new information and milestones through this process. We would be working with our emergency services about how we make sure that's responsive to the changes we're seeing here. And as we said, you know, we'll be looking at planning and land use issues and working with the planners to really think about how our code and zoning is responsive to adaptation. And we imagine that when we get to that project list, we're making sure that we're covering all the city and all operations in the city. So bringing that back to bear to all the departments. Next slide, please. The BCDC gives pretty clear guidance that they would like us to move as close to natural adaptation as we can, using living levees and restorative, and particularly in a place like the Emeryville Crescent, there are a lot of eyes about thinking about how we preserve the function of the habitat within the crescent and how we maintain the aesthetics. But there are a whole spectrum with conventional, and I think we should put a pump up next to that wall, that seawall there, or a combination of those elements. And certainly with the bridge toll plaza right at our front door, the Port of Oakland, East Bay Mud, there may be some compromises and some conversations that we talk about how we do the best solutions for all the users of the Crescent. And next slide, please. As I said early on, we've already applied for the funds with our partners to the north and in collaboration with Oakland to our, I guess in this image, I'd say west in this context. And if we are awarded the funds, we will do it. It will fund us through all those A through ADF that we talked about with BCDC requiring, so that we would come to the point where we had a regional shoreline adaptation plan specific for Emeryville, but in collaboration with all partners in the Crescent. And that we would each adopt them separately, because every 5 years they're going to need to be updated. So we're not going to try and coordinate that return, particularly if specific elements have moved forward. Next slide. But we have to talk to others in the Crescent, because we don't own the land. Most of it's East Bay Regional Park District. Half of it's in Oakland's jurisdiction. The Port of Oakland owns Radio Beach, which is outside of the area we know as the Emeryville Crescent Marine Reserve. And the city of Emeryville's ownership is only of that land that is around our emergency service facilities. The state has a pump, we think, right at the outfall that is leaves them with, I think it's a property. It is not we won't even talk about it in Anchorage, right? And so there is very clear need, and there have been several pre-application conversations about the need to coordinate in the Crescent. Now, this work will, of course, include all of the Emeryville shoreline and north of the marina and at Point Emery, but this is known by all as a particularly complex area, but it also has opportunities. Caltrans is already, can we go to the next slide? Caltrans is already looking at and funding its vulnerability and adaptation strategy around the toll plaza and is looking for the consulting training right now. Army Corps of Engineers has done a pilot in Eden Landing that they now hope to bring by 2027 or, excuse me, my voice is baffling. But by 2028, the possibility, and I'll show you what that might look like. But East Bay Mun is also, and part of the project there is a, is related to how do we have good partners with East Bay Mud adjacent, but they have a project on the marina, Cordova, and I've already, no, this is an additional, their frontline communities, they have grant fundings to move forward with outreach regarding their adaptation for the port facilities adjacent throughout the system, but also adjacent to the Crescent. And San Francisco Estuary Partnership, who is leading the regional partnership we have for planning efforts, also has a feasibility study out today to hire consultants to look at the possibility of living life. And a couple of these that I've alluded to, we have some slides showing them. This is the San Francisco Estuary Partnership's exhibit that they provided in their RFP. They're looking for consultants to evaluate the possibility of horizontal levees throughout the Crescent. Let's go to the next slide. At the same time and separately, Army Corps is looking at the possibility of bringing shallow water sedimentation, and it's pretty cool, you get to call it radio-tagged soil, that they've even analyzed it and watched tidal flexion. They put it out from the mudflat, and then they let the tidal action bring it to the back of the mudflat. Birders and others watching the Eden Project are already very excited about this. And so they will be at, both of these projects will be at Community Day this Saturday, talking about this with the public. So part of our timing in coming here today is to let you know the kind of conversation that are out there. Next slide, please. And in this context, the Regional Shoreline Adaptation Plan requirements are that we do extensive outreach. And that is outreach that it must be equitable in its nature. So this is who doesn't have access, maybe by vehicles or language is a barrier. It's clear that vulnerable populations are another overlay to the risk of sea level rise. There's not economic opportunity to run from the sea as it rises. And so we're looking at equity. Also, the Regional Shoreline Adaptation Plan requirements require that we speak with tribes. So we've already had a preliminary consultation with the Socorotec Land Trust through the visioning work, which I guess is another overlay, which is how we're getting to the Community Day, with SFEP funding co-census to do some preliminary work, which was seen as the ground laying for the grant application for SFEP, which does require. And in that context, that co-census effort that is doing preliminary partnership building with some workshops that are occurring things, and then leading up to this public workshop, which everyone is invited to. And there's also a survey and the fact sheet that goes with this. Has that survey that's being distributed through the cities, and you know, that you help us in extending invitations to that. But as we build this momentum, if funded, the work would begin in October. So we might be able to announce that as we have our cleanup days and our harvest day and start thinking about what that communication to the public like. And in that context, we are prepared and have the draft ready to launch a website where we think for now it'll say, hey, we're applying for funds and there's some public workshops you can come to and some things that are happening so you can get more information. But eventually this will be where, as we embark on all the work with the Regional Shoreline Adaptation, we start to put that vulnerability assessment. Launch that effort, but making sure that it's an open and transparent which is completed. So with presenting all this information to you today. It is an informational item. We just want to make sure you're aware of the event on the 12th and spread the word about that. But we also understand if there's additional information that's needed. It's a complex and broad set of policy issues with both raising concerns and maybe raising aspirations and desires for you could change, thinking about what information can support that, and then our next steps. And I would say that from my point of view, the next step involving the council, at least, will be, if we get that award, we'll be bringing a funding agreement that says USFEP are flowing funds forward to the city of Emeryville so that we can support that regional effort, and we'll enter that funding agreement. And that'll probably come with maybe a similar slideshow to this to the full council, but it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to bring it to the council until we know that's awarded and what we can say about that. If we don't have that awarded, we'll have to step back and rethink what that looks like, the anticipation that would be received.
Great. Thank you, Member. Thank you, Violet. Really helpful. Any questions at this point?
Just one, I get kind of a general question. It was very informative, lots to take in, and there was that one slide that showed all the departments whose work can be affected by this, which is my takeaway from that was everybody, right? Public Works is across the board there, development. I'm just kind of curious, I know we're talking about funding to even study the issue, but what does a public works department do when you're told that your groundwater is going to swell up citywide? Like, how does the planning department, say there's a piece of property that is suddenly going to become emergent groundwater, how do cities use that information? What are some examples? I guess what I'm wondering is, whether do we have any one or two examples of what cities even do in a practical sense to address, mitigate? I think you showed the levee picture, right? Mm-hmm. And which is help, and with the preference for the natural levee. So that's an example of a measure that some can be implemented, probably very expensive, but what would somebody do, to the rest of the city that's, slowly the groundwater is kind of going up? What sort of issues is that causing? How do I think about that and understand that? And what are examples of things, high level buckets of things that departments think about doing?
I'm happy to take the public works one, and if either of you want to take the planning one. So public works side, this is overwhelming, that's an understatement. That being said, civil engineering has been around for a long time, and it's practiced in many places in the world. And there's lots of places that are already built on water, let alone with a high water table or high water level. There's lots of solutions, and all which require significant levels of resourcing. The more you resource it, the less it impacts your quality of life. The less you resource it, the more it impacts how you live. Take a drive on Highway 12 through Lodi and Stockton. Look at how that region, the Sacramento Delta, has been engineered. See vast swaths of land that are lower than the adjacent rivers next to them. Those are all examples of people living below the water level that is adjacent to them, right? In many ways, those are living levees. Yes, they are earth dams, but they are all covered with varying amounts of vegetation and tree lines and so on and so forth. They're all accompanied with pumps at various locations. It's complex. And the common theme is, the difference is that was that example that I just gave was intentional in design, right? This is a reaction that we've been to a situation that has been of our own doing, right? So now, how do we navigate that? We don't have the luxury of pre-designing things. So there's some certain things that are going to be resource prohibitive that you can't fix. And then there are certain things that you can apply resources to. Resource prohibitive things for most of the city is going to be raising parcel levels. That's going to be probably resource prohibitive. You may be able to do it on a parcel by parcel basis. For that, I would defer to our planning team, right? But in general, it's incredibly expensive. The benefit is that we do have our existing storm drain system. It's just going to end up having to do a lot more work than it currently does, as opposed to only really functioning when it rains, right? It's going to be functioning as a regular part of maintaining our health and maintaining our quality of life. And that's going to require possibly larger pipe sizes, pumps, lining. If we're dealing with emergent groundwater, the issues associated with that, all solvable, all requiring resources.
I think one of the context of Emeryville is that the toll plaza is Caltrans' key piece of infrastructure, and I-80 runs our shoreline.
Yep.
And so I have heard those in partnership, I think, with Caltrans in the room, say what we're trying to do here is create a vision that the residents of Emeryville and adjacent communities have vetted and feel comfortable with and understand what the impacts are. And then that's kind of put forward to Caltrans to say, this is what we want to see implemented so that you can protect your infrastructure, but the communities that are adjacent to it are also safe. And so there are, you know, we're reopening questions like a bay trail connection on the Crescent while we build out and have new boarding partners that maybe will start to talk about that. And that might be a berm that's for I-80, or, you know, there's some new possibilities that once that as a partner that's building the things that would just be cost prohibitive for us as a city alone or even as cities in collaboration. So I think, you know, the Caltrans sees the real benefit of SFEP and the cities being involved is to really build that constituency that has a shared vision so that they don't have to manage that process, right? That's difficult and unwieldy for a difficult and unwieldy agency. So we each are coming to it with something that we want their money and they want our process and goodwill and collaborations. So there seems to be a pathway to both building out what we need and what those costs are, and maybe finding a pathway to the money to it. It may be too costly in some options, and we may need to make some hard compromises. But that is, with people that know more about this than myself, are really laying out as kind of the implementation strategy, at least in the Crescent. And then we might, you know, need to think about, is there a simpler solution north of the Crescent or?
Well, ultimately, I mean, for the purposes of this conversation, in terms of the existing land uses, the general plan and the zoning plan, we can't, until that is changed, legally, we cannot restrict the uses that are allowed. So eventually, thankfully for this purpose, the areas that are going to be inundated are not that many. If you look at the Watergate community and you look at all those taller buildings, they remain unimpacted. The whole peninsula was somehow designed to ensure that, you know, so kudos to the civil engineers to be that even down to 2100, those areas are not getting inundated. But eventually, we are going to have to think about this for the entire city, and that place and the time to do that will be the general plan update. And that is going to start, the process is going to start late next year. And at that time, we are going to be challenged with thinking about it in a broader sense. What is the strategy? There's got to be a strategy between what we allow as an entitlement and what we don't. Where do we want our intensity to be? Do we you know, like we have the fire station and the police station, for example, that's, we own that. Do we want housing there or do we not want housing there? How do we prioritize that? And that would feed this study today here, would feed into that process that would impact the rest of the city. So challenge is between how much resources do we have, to what extent, what strategy, philosophical strategy we want to adopt. Do we retreat in certain areas or do we use engineering solutions in others? So those are issues that we will have to think about when we do our joint plan update, because that will be combined with the climate action plan update. But till that is done, legally in terms of entitlement, things will remain the same. So individual parcels, for example, the Hong Kong restaurant, if they go away, what do we do? Right? And we own that property, so that's, you know, so we have a lot more control. But individual parcels that you don't own, then if the land use allows that and they meet all our guidelines, then we have no choice but to ask them. Building codes, again, this is, we are looking further down in the future. How do we, and the city doesn't have that control on that because that's a wider state level. When do they change? How do they change? What are their requirements? What is the height requirement? If we are going to be, you know, if flooding is going to be an issue. So it's a conversation that is complicated and which will require resources. And this is a good way to begin thinking about it because it's coming our way sooner rather than later.
And I would say, you know, in terms of any near-term takeaways, that planning for the police and fire station that is out there, because that is particularly impacted in the scenarios.
Did it look okay?
It's the road access.
Right there.
You know, and not only that, you know, sure, the actual buildings may survive, but then look at their access to the rest of the city. Fire, we have some redundancy. Police, we don't. Right. And I think thinking about that, I know that's one of the items that came up in the hazard mitigation plan as well. There's just, you know, so little connection with the limited connection with the rest of the city, not only with sea rise, but with anything that impacts the freeway. Right. That it's really not a strategic location.
To your question of are there other models, Alameda, the city of Alameda, moved forward with sea level rise adaptation in advance of the new CDC guidance, and are therefore ahead of us in all the steps, and have done some of the work that we would look to model. And certainly the application that was moved forward with for the East Bay Crescent, as it's now called, it's not the Emeryville Crescent, but the East Bay Crescent Operational Landscaping Unit, is both Alameda County and Contra Costa County shoreline to Richmond. And so the operational landscape units have been collaborating in Oakland and Alameda and San Leandro. So those models are being based on for this work here. So we do have both examples of how they've been operationally able to work with each other and the output of their work to help us with.
Thank you. Yeah, and that was a helpful explanation of just how, like, what are the first things that come to mind that your public works have on and development. Like, I like the idea of, okay, some areas you might have to retreat from and say, this is just not workable. Other areas, the future planning code, you could imagine calls for a more, you know, either elevating or robust sump pump system or something, right, in those areas. And maybe the state building codes start to catch up in that regard. I kind of like these, you know, it's like a handful of like concrete things that can help people even visualize how a city manages this without immediately imagining, okay, we have a canal system like Venice, right? So maybe in the future when this presentation reaches the council, there could just be one slide that says, like, you know, here's some high level considerations that other cities have implemented, thing that we will have to start thinking about from the perspective of the various departments. I think that could be helpful for council members to just have something concrete to ground themselves to. Thank you.
One question. So obviously the specific land in the Emeryville Crescent, East Bay Crescent, is, how Oakland approaches its portion right next to us, so that matters. Does it matter, it's a science question, but like, does it matter what, like, I don't know, like, some city in the South Bay does down there? Because, like, I know the, like, does that, is it how...
Water flows.
Yeah, how regional does this have to be for it to... I mean, we're not going to mitigate the entire thing, but like, does,
We don't have that information, but the consultants that are written into the grant are the same consultants that are working on Oakland and Alameda's, right? So they have methodology and have the information to be able to say, okay, you're putting a seawall here, who gets the water, right? And BCDC had a slide that I didn't know how to interpret it, but it was about hydraulic flows. So I think that the region is certainly looking at that. And one of the things we really appreciate about having San Francisco Estuary Partnership lead the effort is then making sure that we're having those conversations that flow into, you know, so if you have San Francisco Estuary Institute, different organization might have the data that can inform them. I think everybody that is set up as our subs are plugged into enough of the rest of what's happening in the region to be able to attend to that question.
Gotcha. Maybe I'll just open a public comment unless there are any other questions. Any comment cards that comes to the room?
No.
This is just echoing anymore. This is really interesting and scary, but interesting and important. I'm glad we're, you know, 2060 doesn't feel so far away, but it's not that far away. So I'm glad we're having the conversation now.
I was gonna say that in preparing this presentation, we saw a planning intern had prepared a not so dissimilar, different data, different consequences, about 5 years. And so I think the good news is we've written the grant application, we've made the partnerships, things have moved forward versus if you'd gotten it 5 years ago, it would just been, you know, a little farther. Right. So the step forwards have been made.
Certainly. I think that, you know, I really appreciate the thinking on, like, how can we do this with sort of a natural hat on, from like a hippie blog, it's like I like that idea, but also I feel like there's an opportunity as well, like, how can we sort of clean up the bay, you know, wildlife, all those sorts of things. And that's something where I imagine the kind of the more groups that are involved, kind of the, you know, from some wildlife perspective, that's presumably better. And then also just to echo Mayor Moore's point about, like, what specific actions can be taken, I think both in terms of mitigation, but also, you know, if we're getting to a point where there is a once every 10 years, you know, emergency that happens, like, what is our working with police, fire, public works, finding, like, what is our emergency response look like? What are the investments we should make? You know, whether that's moving police headquarters or having an emergency response center that has batteries and solar and all those things. Making sure that, like, some of these things are going to happen and communities are going to be impacted, but how we prepared, maybe that's the least expensive, you know, in some instances that might be the least expensive choice, is to say, after 10 years, we're going to need to have this emergency response, and that's going to make a quality of life that much better. I imagine that's part of these conversations, but certainly would be interested in that being that part of it.
And maybe improve our tsunami warning information. Yeah, I think the definitely it's a lot of information. It's good that we're talking about it. We don't just have our, you know, covering our eyes thing like, oh yeah, this thing is scary and coming. So at least this is the start of kind of concrete action. And yeah, any opportunity, like, it feels very overwhelming, especially to a small city, right? Where any bandwidth towards something like this is completely coming at the expense of other efforts. So trying to leverage the work of other our neighbors, regional partnerships, just so that we're not trying to solve this problem on our own. And even if we're successful, we'll, you know, the water will just come in from our neighbors, right?
Yeah.
So thanks for putting this on our radar. Something to think about.
Awesome. Thank you both. Appreciate it. Now that we've solved sea level rise and groundwater management to 6.3 environmental programs. For Matt Bellman updates.
All right. Great. Brief updates for you. Happy to report that the tree planting bid has gone out. We received bids. $712,000 was the low for planting 125 trees around the city. They'll be coming to council for approval next week. So look forward to that.
Which was
8% under our engineer's estimate. So if we got a good deal, very excited about that. And there's also additional scope in there to do plantings as issues arise around the city for tree knockdowns, things like that.
Will that have a math report, all those?
Yes, there is. Within the report, there's the plant specs. One quick report on state legislative thing. AB 306 was passed as part of a budget trailer, and AB 306 was disallowing local jurisdictions to make building code amendments for residential buildings through 2031, majority except for life and safety ones. And so that essentially curtails most environmental reach codes that will be happening over the next couple of years. And then also of note today, AVA, our community energy provider, has released an e-bike incentive program between $400 to $1,500 and with additional $250 for e-bike equipment. And there, we can send around information after this. We posted it on our socials. We appreciate you all passing that along. But there's monthly drawings through September 2026, and that is available to all AVA customers. And that's all I have for today.
Thank you. Anything else or question?
Just one question on the tree planting. Does that include, I know the locations, and then does the vendor then also specify the tree variety that's being planted there?
Yes. Yep. The species is
there. Do we specify anywhere that we want some type of root structure that does not lift up our concrete if it's adjacent to sidewalks? Because that just gives us more concrete grinding issues. Is that like a...
Yep. We do indeed. Yes. Okay, in fact, that was actually a little bit of why the trees are a little bit more expensive than you think of just planting the tree out in soil. There's going to be work putting the structural soil in, so the roots go underneath adjacent concrete and not up. And then also there's going to be the type of felt fabric that's put in so it doesn't push up through the concrete, in addition to other soil limits that are happening.
Great. Yeah, I feel like that's something that can't be underemphasized. Yeah, I'm thinking about the hopped onto the sidewalk over here on Hollis on my way down, and it's just like a roller coaster. But even other places, like you think about the Greenway, where these little lips start forming, and then, you know, any little lip is something that can catch a kid's scooter or somebody can trip on. So we don't want to create more problems, but while trying to beautify the city.
And I should note there too, there are any locations where there are issues or the tree well isn't large enough, actually concrete work of cutting out the concrete and making the tree well larger to make sure it's sufficient space, and then either adding concrete or making it safe is part of this code as well.
Great. Excellent. Any other questions?
No.
Any public comment?
Unless you
Yep. Any other discussion?
None for me.
You may appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
Moving to item 6.4, capital improvement program tracking spreadsheet.
A couple of projects I want to committee on. First, the streetscapes. The work continues on Hollis with the green infrastructure installations. They finished work, I believe, at the corner at the intersection of Stanford and Hollis with the installation of the concrete basin for the green infrastructure, as well as the flatwork improvements for the curb extensions. So that's good progress there, and they've started work at the 53rd intersection for those curb extensions, and shortly they will begin work on the green infrastructure there as well. So work continuing on that project, and as I mentioned earlier, we do hope that they start paving towards the end of the summer, you know, August.
Just a small site on Stanford. I think if you happen to be in the area, it's nice to actually stand there because you can actually see the intent of the project. It's been so long where you see the checkered board effectiveness, then not that corner. But finally, at Stanford and Hollis, you can actually see how much the obstruction is shrunk with all of the expanded sidewalk.
Trip over to Adams.
And then 40th Street, just a small update on that. That work continues with Caltrans on the environmental process that continues to move forward and work with the tribal entities to continue their process. And we do hope to have environmental clearance by the end of the year.
On the 40th Street, so how long? I know we're trying to, I know for a while we've been trying to get the tribal clearance. Is there anything holding that up? Is this the normal course? Like, is it like a conversation? Like, what does that look like?
Normal course, because it's not defined necessarily by a set of requirements, it's a conversation. It's difficult to define the timeline, but right now it's by the end of the year.
Okay, so it's a conversation, but we, coming out of that conversation, we don't expect, it's like you had the conversation, but there's not a there's not like a veto point or what's the, I guess, what type of, is it just like a box that we're checking? How does that work?
No, it's a serious discussion with stakeholders. Because of the nature of the area, especially around the extension. Mm-hmm. And so it really is dependent on the outcome of those conversations.
Got it. Okay. One other question. We mentioned earlier the asphalt speed humps being added on 66th and 67th. Should that be, would it be appropriate to add those on anywhere on this list?
It's a part of the Sustainable Streetscapes project.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That we've done under the same contract as the Sustainable. So Bay Cities currently are working on the, that's our contractor. Bay Cities are currently working on the flat work. Their sub is working on the flat work for the curb extensions on Hollis Street. And once they mobilize for paving, the asphalt paving, then they'll be able to work on the curb, the speed humps throughout town.
And the flat work being?
Oh, sorry, flat work being sidewalk.
But would it be too small of a detail to add to that line item? I think if somebody was browsing this, they could see.
Oh, yeah,
I'm just saying like as a quick addition there, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Is there, sorry, I can set this up, but on the city website, is there under sustainable streetscapes like a full, not counting, but like just a, like, here's all the cool things we're doing under this year's Sustainable Streetscapes program. include, I guess, if I was...
we can create one.
Okay, I don't want to, like, add another.
No, that's a reasonable request.
We can work on that. Yeah, just because all of these cool things we add daily.
Yeah.
I think that's a reflection of we're being very smart with. We have people out on the street doing work. We should just do all of these other things we know. So,
yeah. By design.
Yes. Okay. Any other questions?
None for me.
Any public comment on this item?
No.
Okay. Any other discussion?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Closing on 6.4. And moving to future agenda items. It looks like for September, we have a couple things on the agenda, full calendar maybe.
Yeah, the lift bay wheels was meant to be in this meeting, but it was pushed.
Mm-hmm. What is MRP?
Yeah, the municipal regional permit. It's the regional stormwater. I know a little bit about it.
Yeah.
It's the regional stormwater quality
gotcha.
Stuff.
You got the acronym right.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any future agenda items?
I just had one clarifying question on the C-Click fix. City manager, she had sent an email out to the council a few weeks ago encouraging us to point people to C-Click fix. And I wasn't sure if she had was simply reminding people about the program that exists, or was there a development that made it worthwhile to promote it more broadly, or maybe it's just the same as it's always been?
Not necessarily. Things have changed on the staffing side.
Okay.
So we now have an operations manager, which is, you know, the primary position responsible for, you know, intake of most C-Click fix items for public works and ensuring that they get done. Mm-hmm. And we also closed out a lot of items that had been done but hadn't been closed out from over an extended period of time. So, but we do plan on bringing you guys a good presentation in a few weeks.
Do we think, I see September's already full, would it just be appropriate, and can we see it this year?
Yes, this year is very recent.
Okay, great. I have nothing to add.
We move on from this item. Yeah. Just wanted to mention there's an omission. I know last meeting, the Raptor program, we asked to have that included on the.
Oh, yes, yes, that's right.
It was just left off on accident. I apologize.
Oh, yeah. Just meant thanks for, and we were going to augment it with the owl boxes.
Is public comment allowed on the future agenda? Or... No. Can I ask a question?
Sure. I'll allow it.
Thank you. Just the staff support for every go around planning, I think that's great. That's something we've asked for. I was wondering what is the sort of concept there? Like, what's the staff support that we're not sure?
I think it's premature.
Premature, okay. Because we also want to do the other direction as well, where the ETMA can help provide input or support for transportation planning that involves Emory go round as well. So going both ways, just to throw that out there. So
yeah, just as I think that item was referred from council, and I think it was there's some capacity and like what is the scope of our work questions that didn't know what it was. So,
I did have one question. I know Mohammed, you mentioned there's are we gonna see anything related to like this signage initiative program? We were talking about signs on the, so it's included in wayfinding, like the new speed limits on the greenway perhaps.
So I think right now our thinking has been case by case. The speed limits came up in the context of the greenway with a separate request. We've integrated it into that. We will be having a citywide additional update on speed limits that is in the hopper with our traffic consultants, but that's
got it.
That will be coming around.
So I do have maybe one future agenda item, and this is kind of related to signs on the greenway. On some sections of the greenway, which we consider park space, we have some no smoking signs. What I've noticed is a lot of people don't take their smoke breaks out on the benches of the greenway because it's a nice place if you're a smoker, but it also means if you're going out for a run or biking, you're just breathing cigarette smoke. So I was hoping that we could kind of add more of those no smoking signs that are already on portions of the greenway, but to kind of emphasize that message so that people see that this is not a place to be smoking in park space. So I don't know the best way to, I guess we could call it a greenway signage as a future agenda item, or if you want to roll it into wayfinding or whatever's most, whatever's
easiest. That could be a standalone. That's fine. We'll add it to the future agenda items.
Okay. So let's say the item will be greenway signage.
I don't know. What?
Okay. Nothing else? Move to announcements and member comments?
None from me.
No. And with that, I will adjourn. It is 5:36. Thank you all.
Thanks, everyone.